Need to go across to Asia and to our correspondent Ed White. Kia ora, Ed, thanks for being with us today. Starting with this marathon Indian election, which is underway, and Prime Minister Narendra Modi eyeing his third five-year term in power.
Yes, good morning, Susie. So, yes, India, the world's biggest democracy, is 1 week down into its six-week election process. And while there is obviously a lot of time still, there is currently really very little doubt that Narendra Modi, who is this populist prime minister, and his political party, the BJP, will be returned to power for what will be their third five-year term in a row. And what is really at stake, and what seems also perhaps quite likely, is that Modi's on a mission to expand the BJP's majority, which has already been about half the seats in India's lower house of parliament. And he's, you know, looking to really further sideline the country's opposition groups. Now, in the weeks leading up to the election, Modi has been front and center of the BJP campaign as usual. The key campaign slogan has been Modi's guarantees. And the message has really been about expanding his already hugely popular welfare schemes, which benefit hundreds of millions of poorer Indians, but also continuing on to develop this sort of fast-growing economy and continuing to really rapidly improve the infrastructure in India. And look, according to some of his critics, there has also been a lot more signalling this time around Modi's vision for reviving and boosting Hinduism, India's majority religion, and giving it an even more central place in India's public life. And so, just to that end, in January, as part of his campaigning, Modi led the opening of a huge new Hindu temple in northeast India. And this was built on a site which about 30 years ago, Hindu zealots actually tore down a mosque. So very clear signaling there on what Modi is trying to do. And look, for their part, the opposition groups in India, including the most prominent opposition leader, Rahul Gandhi, look, they continue to try to rally against what they see as creeping authoritarianism, the sort of dodgy ties as well between India's richest businessmen and politicians with Modi. They also point to stubborn unemployment, which does continue to be a real weak point for Modi and his government's record. But look, at this stage, it does seem, and polling is tricky in India, but it does seem pretty likely that by the 1st of June, when polls close, Modi is quite well on his way to expanding his power base and starting a new five-year term with an even stronger mandate than he has since he first took power in 2014.
And reporters in India have also been uncovering details about the inner workings of the BJP political machine, which, of course, is driving Modi's campaigns.
Yeah, so look, we've spoken for several years around, there's been a lot of reporting around Modi's success and how that's been attributed really to his charisma as a leader, his ability to tap in and tap into and possibly at times even fuel this growing sense of Hindu nationalism in India. And there's obviously been a lot of concern about this, including the marginalization and fears of persecution of the Muslim minority and other smaller religious groups and ethnic groups in India. But what has not been quite well understood, and I think what people have really been digging into in India this time round, is just the immense political machine that Modi and the BJP now boasts. And so India has obviously the world's biggest population, about 1.4 billion people, but the BJP, Modi's party, claims it has about 180 million members. And just for a point of comparison, that would be nearly close to double the number of Communist Party members here in China. And these numbers are of course impossible to verify, but there's no doubt that the BJP is a highly efficient and hugely expansive political operation. And this means it can just mobilize tens of millions of people out onto the streets to go door knocking as part of these huge campaigns, not just to push policies, but also to kind of crowd out opposition forces. And so, in a kind of sign of how this is being done and how well organized they are, reporters on the ground in India this year have struggled to actually find neighborhoods or villages without BJP volunteers there and supporters actively pushing the party's agenda. And there's also a very well-resourced operation pushing people on social media. And this has been extremely successful, I think, in reaching and influencing groups by people by their occupation, so key lines that they might vote on. So sort of banding together, for instance, groups around like shopkeepers or farmers with common messaging. And look, for their part, the party actually says this membership is a really important group. They say it plays a positive role in monitoring India's massive bureaucracy, helping to stamp out low-level corruption, which has been a real drain on India's economy and on its welfare programs for many years. But look, one final point on this, which people haven't really been able to answer, is around campaign financing. So there are a lot of questions still around where all of Modi and the BJP's money and donations come from, how much they are actually able to work with, and all of that's a huge question, but little doubt that the opposition groups are really increasingly unable to compete.
Really extraordinary. It'll be absolutely fascinating to watch that all play out. Let's go to China now. It's in the spotlight in Europe this week following a series of arrests.
Yeah, look, it's been something of a wild ride for China and its interests overseas this week. So starting Monday, two men in the UK were charged with spying for China. These were one person in his late 20s, another in his early 30s. They were actually arrested back in March 2023, and they're finally due to appear in court later in the today, actually, in the UK. Details of the case there are quite vague, but it appears the pair were basically accused of providing information to the Chinese state as part of some sort of research work that they were doing. One of the men, through a lawyer last year, said he was completely innocent, but we'll see what happens there. And then also, look, in Germany on Monday, news broke out that three German citizens, including a husband and wife team, had been apprehended on allegations of attempting to sell military technology to Chinese interests. And then a day later, the German police said that they had also picked up a man who was working for a far right-wing member of the European Parliament on charges of spying for China. The next day, the drama sort of continued with raids on a Chinese security equipment company called Nuketech, and those raids were in Rotterdam and Warsaw. Look, these were a real surprise because the company had actually been in Europe for many years. It, in fact, has won hundreds of public tenders, and its key products, which are like scanners for people and cargo and baggage, are used at border checkpoints and ports all across Europe. And so one of the interesting things here is that this raid, according to the European authorities, this was done on the grounds that the company had received unfair foreign subsidies. But really, in the background, the raid and all of these arrests all come down to this sharpening focus over China, particularly the perceived threat that it poses to countries' national security. I know in New Zealand recently there have been issues around cybersecurity and China. So it's this sort of great and increasing focus that governments everywhere are having around this. Just, you know, in terms of the Chinese response, unsurprisingly, Beijing's responded pretty angrily. It's been hitting out against what they call protectionism from the West. And actually in Beijing, the German ambassador was called in for a dressing down from the Chinese authorities as well.
Mm. Now, finally, a quick word on Taiwan, because debate over the death penalty is resuming.
Yeah, look, so in a region, you know, dominated by countries like China and India, Taiwan is actually often held up as a sort of bastion of free speech and democracy and progressive liberal values, including famously in 2019 legalizing same-sex marriage, which was a first in Asia. But one area that there's been long criticism of the government in Taipei, both from civil society and foreign groups, has been the continued use of the death penalty. And so there are currently about 37 inmates who have been sentenced to death in Taiwan. And look, it's extremely grim, but the process is completely politicized. And so basically what happens is when times are tough for the government's presidents, they'll decide somebody's time's up. But the Constitutional Court in Taipei is hearing arguments on this, and there may be a change, but it's going to be extremely tense. It's extremely controversial in Taiwanese society, but we might see some progress on this over the coming months.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you. Ed White, our correspondent in Asia this morning